now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
All right, everybody, shut your goddamn traps and sit down. You probably recognize me. I'm Assistant Librarian, the Chris Keeper. Every year, we separate the boys and girls of the 7th grade and bring them to their own separate assemblies. Now, you may have noticed that your body's starting to go through a lot of awkward changes, and you're starting to have sort of feelings about things, and you might have some questions, so we have provided a hygiene film for you. Yes, this movie should answer any questions that you have. From the growth of the first little weird hair, till the part where your girlfriend has to sort of mercy kill you with a shotgun to the face. You'll see, it's all in the movie. So this film comes from a nice Canadian doctor, Dr. Cronenberg, OBGYN. It's called The Fly. All right, well, without any... What? What are the girls watching? Well, they're in the other room with the librarian, Mistress Nocturna, and they're watching Carrie. That's the movie for girls. You'll see, inside of 2 hours, the entire 7th grade should have all their questions answered. And peace shall be restored to the hallways of Miskatonic Middle School. All right, so sit down, shut the fuck up, and pay attention and learn something. Here we go.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I am one of your co-hosts this evening, Mr. Luke Jackanetti. I'd like to thank everyone for downloading and joining us today. Easy for me to say. But I can't do this alone. So left to right, or is that right to left? We're going to be transporting back and forth throughout the episode, so you're going to have to keep that straight, okay? So over there, literally climbing the walls, my brother, Mr. Jason Jackanetti.
What? His cock?
Oh, you fucking stole mine, you
motherfucker. Well, you heard him there, the guy who had no longer has any fingernails or teeth, Mr. Hair Metal Hero Chris Tyler.
Cheeseburger.
That was my backup.
And, of course, we couldn't do this without, the OG himself over there vomiting up some sort of an enzyme onto his food to eat it, Mr. Chris Honeywell.
I puked on my tricycle.
okay.
Set me up perfectly for my line, too. You didn't even know.
I didn't even know it. So you look at that. My line is, is this a romance we're having here? So if you can't tell from this and our various attempts at doing a Jeff Goldblum impression,
who could have
predicted that Gina Davis would jump out of a moving vehicle and I'd be here by myself
talking to myself.
So set your way back machine. Set your way back machine, and I'm gonna trigger a few folks possibly on this call. Set your way back machine 40 years, 40 friggin' years to August of 1986, because we are taking a look at David Cronenberg's The Fly. And in fact, as we're recording this, we are 40 years and one day from the release of The Fly. And, you know, what's funny is that I saw this movie probably when I was way too young, because I saw this either when I was 6 or 7 years old.
I was going to say that, too.
And you know what? My memory of this is that, man, this is like the grossest film ever, and my opinion has not changed in the intervening 40 years.
So I remember when we saw this. So we were, it had come out, we didn't see it in the theaters. It had come out on VHS. Dad had it, and he said, okay, we're going to watch The Fly. And I said, okay. So we sat down to watch the movie. It was like a Saturday afternoon or something, because Mom was working. Yes. It was just us home. And we sat down and watched it. And I said, is that how he turns into? And Dad's like, I'm not telling you. Don't talk during the movie. Because Dad used to hate when I asked questions.
You cannot. But that was like the ultimate sin in a movie in our house. If you gave something away during the movie, oh my God. That's one of the angriest I've ever seen my dad. So.
Yeah. But I hadn't seen it yet. Because I didn't know how much he would change, right? And I knew everyone had said, like, the whole movie is supposed to be so gross. I'm like, okay. But we literally watched the movie. Whatever. I mean, we were definitely too young to see this movie. I was 9, you were 7 or whatever, you know, 8 and 6, whatever. Then we went down to the elementary school and played basketball, which, because we were just getting into basketball.
What?
And then we went out for frozen yogurt at TCBY when it used to exist in Brewster and doesn't anymore. I remember, I don't know why I remember this shit. Dude, it's so crystal in my memory. And then, like, other days I don't remember at all, but I remember this. So,
sounds like a good
that's,
day.
I know it's super local for most of you because none of you were there except Luke and I and Dad, but there you go.
I remember TCBY, just not your TCBY.
Yeah, right. Well, and I remember because we were at TCBY and we ran into the Lynches, Maureen, Kathleen, and Johnny, because they were like,
that's
hey.
About as Irish a family
yes.
as you can get.
Oh my God, dude, holy shit, they're really Irish.
Hey, were they all ginger?
Yes.
I was just going to ask.
Yes, they were definitely... it's just funny.
White
funny
as taste.
Yeah, but it's just one of those things that sometimes I have certain things that are like seared into my memory. Like I remember, even though I was really young, going to the theater to see Aliens. Like I remember that. I remember seeing Predator and RoboCop together at the theater. Like, because you know why? We didn't go to the movies often. So like going to the movies or seeing things, certain movies, I don't remember when I ever saw them, but I know like we saw Predator and RoboCop together in a sneak preview because it was the best sneak preview thing you ever had. It was better than Harry
Still
and the Hendersons.
Still jealous. Every time you tell that story, I get more jealous.
So it was better than Harry and the Hendersons and Innerspace, better than Red Heat and
Short Circuit 2.
It was better than Big and Die Hard, although Big and Die Hard was pretty fucking cool. And what was the other one? Shit, what did we see Predator 2 with? Predator 2 was with something. I don't remember what that was.
Ooh, I don't recall. Yeah.
Or was Predator 2 with something? I mean, we definitely went and saw Predator 2. It might not have been with anything.
Yes. I don't recall, to be honest.
There were times when we would go to the movies and go see two movies, but they weren't a sneak preview sometimes. Anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah. But I'm saying this, for some reason, seeing The Fly was seared into my brain that because we sat down at that, Dad's like, we're going to watch this. And I'm like, okay. Like, Dad was like, you need to see this movie. And I was like, okay. Like, you know,
the thing about this movie is that, now, first off, I do want to say, this being a horror wreck hanger-on, I do want to talk about that VHS release. Mm-hmm. The Fly, a well-known VHS release, mostly, I think, because it is from CBS Fox Video. And if you're the right age, you know the CBS Fox Video look. They all had a uniform sleeve, right? They had the same CBS Fox trade dress, and that included on the side panel, it was just this kind of like dark gray with white text, and it was all, they all were looked exactly the same, right, on the side. So you'll, if you know what I'm talking about, you'll see it. If you look up the VHS of The Fly, you'll get exactly what I'm seeing. But all the CBS Fox films were like this, whether they were horror, romance, comedy, whatever. So that tape was very, very common, and I have one in my collection. It's a great old horror tape. But the thing about this is that, again, being the age that I was when I saw it, it's like I remember it being gross. I remember the scary shit and the gross shit. But it's like there is so much sex in this movie.
right? Mm. That is, I mean, Jeff, it's, I mean, Seth says that. He talks about that. I don't know enough about the flesh. I've really got to learn about the flesh. And it's like, that means one thing in the context that he's talking about, but it really is about the fact that, you know, he doesn't have that human connection. And in his attempt that he thinks he's making himself more human, he makes himself into a monster. And the eat and fuck and reproduce and die, right? That's the life cycle of a fly. And it's like that, yeah. None of that made any impression at seven, right?
I'm working on all that stuff other than the reproducing.
So, right. Yeah.
You know. Yeah. But I'm saying, but at the age of seven or eight, that's going over your head. I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, though, because as long as you watch it later on, this is one of those movies that it's like almost perfect. And it's, there's no fat, lots of guts, no fat. Yeah. It's kind of the forerunner of elevated horror before but the thing is no, David Cronenberg.
What it is, it's the pinnacle of what a quote unquote B movie can be.
It is, but it's with a B movie with A movie production. But yeah. The thing is, David Cronenberg's reputation was like the pinnacle of his reputation at this point was Scanners and probably Videodrome, you know, and which are both like super sleazy and bloody. But this movie, like, I was in the first like half hour, 40 minutes of this movie, I'm like, there's a lot of this is just being carried by Goldblum and Gina Davis and the script. It's just their characters are both appealing and natural feeling people. And it's interesting and amusing to watch them just interacting with each other and the story playing out, you know?
I mean, if either one of them was a total dick, like, you would have zero sympathy. And right. This movie doesn't work if Seth is...
He's a little annoying, but in an endearing way, you know?
He's annoying because he doesn't understand interacting with another human, let alone being in love with one, right? Yeah, I mean, the reason I had that line, is this a romance that we're having? Because I love it, because he doesn't... that is what they're doing. This is Cronenberg doing a legitimate romance. But it's a romance where one of them is not just dying, but is dying literally by his own hand. And then goes through the stages of dealing with his disease, for lack of a better term, right?
Yeah.
And it's so well acted.
Mm-hmm. I think this was where the critics realized, though, that David Cronenberg was like a real filmmaker, because they started talking about this going, this is a very well shot and well acted and well scripted movie and stuff, because they were used to like, you know, just more crazy stuff, sort of like David Lynch got a reputation as a real filmmaker as time went on.
Yeah,
but but they didn't know to call it like elevated or whatever. They were just like, wow, David Cronenberg is really developing as a filmmaker and stuff, but at the same time he just stuffs it full of the like grossest shit, like as gross as anything that he did in any of it, in Videodrome or anything like that. Even worse, because it's like Jeff Goldblum's having like puberty cancer. So it's got the worst of both things of, like, you know, your body degenerating, but at the same time, your body's also, like, dripping new fluids and stuff. It's just...
Yeah.
So part of the thing, though, if you think about it, right, is that, like, in Videodrome, like, even though there might be, like, Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum having sex and doing all that stuff like that, in the movie, they're two people who are together doing it. In Videodrome, it's all about... like, it's this voyeurism. You're watching this stuff. Like, it's torture. It's whatever. I mean, all the even when James Woods is, you know, he's him and what, I forgot her name. They have sex in the movie. Debbie Harry, right? But then, like, he's then like lean. He's like into the TV. Then he has a vagina in his chest, and he reaches in, and a cancer gun comes out. Like, the movie just is like it's just too much for. mainstream society to even get their head around. No, to get their head around.
There was
around,
a lot of it of like, is this reality? Is he hallucinating? Right. You know, and all that. Whereas The Fly is a straightforward just story. You know, it's straight up.
It's a mad scientist.
Everybody
gets a mad scientist.
Yeah.
It's Seth Brundle is Frankenstein and the monster.
Yeah. Mm. So the thing is, exactly. So you're able to, like, even though what's on the screen might be pushing the boundaries of what normal people would want to see by way of things that are disgusting to them, it's someone turning into a fly and they're like, whatever you, but I mean, what he's really, it's really happening to him. And this is what the people have always said, like, well, this is an allegory for AIDS or this is an allegory for cancer. It doesn't matter what he's,
you know, whatever
he's dying
or puberty, anything that goes wrong with your body is.
So
is
everyone can, at some point can connect with that. And you can connect with the idea that he's going from one thing to another, and the metamorphosis that's happening, whether that metamorphosis is going from being healthy to dying or going from being adolescent to an adult or whatever it might be, everyone's experienced something of that in their lives. And what you find is when you look back, when people now look back, and it's 40 years, people who saw this when they were, you know, maybe in their 20s and whatever, now who are in their 60s and how have lost people or maybe have gone through cancer or maybe have watched people die, you know, they take something more personal into the movie with them, and it allows you to get a different you know, perspective on what you're looking at. It doesn't change the celluloid that, you know, is unspooling in front of you. What's changing is who you are as a viewer, and that's one of the hardest things I think for some people to kind of come to terms with. I think sometimes I have found personally that movies that used to not impact me as much now have much more meaning to me now that I'm older and the stuff I've gone through and the stuff, you know, whatever. Whereas when I was younger, I kind of just watched it for whatever. Now I still enjoy the whatever, but the allegory that's there that was lost on you. I think that's one of the biggest, when you look back, especially you can look in the early 80s, but because there wasn't a ton there, but it's like right in the prime 80s, like I want to say 82, like to like 87 or so, there are movies in there that were ahead of their time. And people didn't quite understand it all yet. And now when they look, and it wasn't appreciated for some of them for at least, you know, into the 90s or maybe 2000s. But like, I mean, honestly, let's think about it. That this movie was as well received, and that Chris Wallace won the Academy Award for Best Special for Special Effects and Makeup. Okay, I get it. Right, that makes perfect sense. But if you look back at this, the Carpenter's The Thing was vilified when it came out. Like, people hated that movie, and it's like, but now it's looked about as one of the just classic, right? Because what it was showing you was stuff the people didn't want to see. Necessarily not, and that is gross, but they didn't want to see that the horror that's inside themselves, the you know, the enemy could be there. We're now watching, as you go through there, Cronenberg does it in his movies too. I think with this, with The Fly, does so much better than Videodrome, and I love Videodrome, but it now, like I said, the horror is not, is it him hallucinating, is it like some crazy thing? Like, no, I mean, the stuff that happens to you, you're like, the fuck?
It's,
you know?
It's very straightforward what's happening in it, you know? It's just like, it's that going downhill feeling where you can't stop, and you're just speeding up as you go down the hill. It's an inevitable conclusion, you know, that just gets worse and worse.
And plus, think about this, in this movie, again, in the mid-80s, there were, I mean, major films that dealt with the topic of abortion. The abortion is part of this movie. Like, she, as soon as she's pregnant, she goes, I'm getting an abortion. And he goes,
oh, yeah, they did
not
pussyfoot around it either. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing. He's, we're getting the abortion tonight. We're going. And it's like, the doctor's like, just come back in the morning. Like,
I feel for the obstetrician. Because the doc is like, it's like, look, I'm okay doing that. But it's like 10:30 at night here, guys. You know?
You know? But that's what I'm saying. So, like, Cronenberg has never shied away from, topics and
much
issues
of anything.
That might,
right.
Well, I'm saying, but he's never shied away from that. Where some directors might kind of pussyfoot around it, he's like, no, fucking put it in the front. And think about it. She wants to have the abortion, not because it's because she knows that this could be this creature inside of her, right? And he breaks in, which is always a great scene. I love when he knocks down those glass things, because I've always wanted to do that from like since that point. I'm like, every time I see someone, I'm like, I want to knock those over. But you know what I'm saying? But he steals her away. But it's not like she's fighting him to not get taken, right? She's like, okay, like, because she still loves him. And it's like, God damn it. Like, Cronenberg, are you kidding me? Like, with these deeper things. And it doesn't hurt that at the time, Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis were, like, they were, like, the hot couple. And they were, like, you know, they were together and all this stuff. But they said they were so madly in love with each other. And so it made the scenes where they're doing that easier, because they didn't have to fake chemistry because they had it. Which a lot of times I'm always surprised. I'm always shocked when I like will see, not surprised, but like oh my God, like you watch something, you're like, oh yeah, we hated each other. You find out like the co-stars, you're like, wow, they're really good actors then, because I bought it that they actually liked each other. But sometimes you have people who are like, we don't really care about each other, and then you kind of tell they don't have it. They clearly were into each other.
A lot of times they discourage, you know, a director will discourage having a couple on screen on time, because if something goes wrong, it could ruin the whole movie, you know?
It
often happens during, you know, during they'll hook up while they're doing the movie and meet when they've met each other. But usually that, like, you know, like maybe like an Eyes Wide Shut sort of deal, but most of the time they sort of try to avoid that, you know?
Well, that was one of the things that
worked out great here.
Yeah. Well, the thing is,
I think that's why the critics, it gave all that element of it gave the critics. That's why they hated the thing. But this movie had stuff that the critics could. That's why I compare it to Elevated Horror. This movie gave stuff to the critics that let them go like, oh, I can recommend this movie and still say like, oh, there's great chemistry between these two, and it's a tragic love story and all that. It gave them everything to like be able to recommend this movie, and God bless it, because you know there's so many people who saw their first, like, you know, fingernail pulled off on film, you know. And I remember the
medicine cabinet is what always got me.
That whole scene All that juicy stuff. I remember like vividly in the theater, the people just like, you know, the cringing sounds, and like, oh yeah, no, you know, and through all and the arm wrestling scene too, that got a huge huge wince out of the crowd. It was great.
The other thing is too, is that obviously you don't have a humongous cast here, right? There's not like 20 different people you got to remember. Like, there's
like three people,
main characters,
sets.
And like tertiary people. You're not in a lot of places. It's not convoluted. You know, it's messy.
Like a novella in a pulp 40s magagazine. You know, it's just like a good 60 page story. Mm-hmm. You know, straightforward beginning, middle, end. And
think about it.
Like a good Italian movie, at the end, it just ends. Just ends. I fucking love it. Like a good giallo. It just like, are we done with the story? Is it okay? We don't need to know how anybody feels after the story.
No, there's no
denouement
in this.
He's dead. Is he dead? He's dead. Okay, the end. You know.
Yeah.
A lot. It's a lot like American Werewolf in London sort of does that. Oh, he's dead. Bow, 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 bow.
So, obviously, you know, we've been talking a lot about this kind of thing. And this is still a film that when you, how to put this, there are certain horror movies that non-horror fans can watch and be okay with. And the story here is not the special effects. I want to start to give Chris Wallace his props here. And his whole crew. It's not just him. The makeups of the movie. Now, everyone kind of knows, if you've ever been to Universal Studios and sat through the makeup thing, that the fly at the very end, you know, he comes out of the machine and whatever, that's what the fry looks like. But not that for, that's only like the last couple minutes of the movie.
Yeah, just a few minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. Where it's that fully transformed, bug eye. But it's a lot of Jeff Goldblum acting through the makeup in the other makeups. He's still acting through it. And he has to put on all the ticks and all the fly type movements and the way he does. It's just, there's more here than a lot of people. I understand. Some people can't get past, like my wife could not sit through this. I don't think she's ever watched The Fly.
Maureen loves Goldblum, and I've yet to show her this because I know the gooiness is going to be too much.
Like put it this way. Haley's never seen this, but Haley's seen The Thing. Well, she watched The Thing when she was little. I know that I don't think Kelly could get through. I don't know if she's ever seen The Fly. I don't think she could get through this, even now knowing, and she understands special effects and stuff, because some of the stuff that happens is just, it's not the fly at the end. It's the throwing, it's the vomiting on the things, the finger. It's all the little things. You're like, okay, it's the same way that I always say to people, if they've never seen Audition, it's hard to explain it to them. But in Audition, it's not the big things that she does. It's the needles. It's when she sits on all the. It's when she sits on them and drives all the needles deeper. Yeah. Right. It's the piano. It's the little things. It's to me. It's always the little things. It's the needles. The little
things. It's the little things because we've all been pricked with a nail.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of us have lost a fingernail.
Yes.
The first time you lose a fingernail.
We've all vomited.
Yeah.
You lose a fingernail and you're lifting it up and you're like. God! And then realize it's coming all the way up, and it's just this and you feel compelled to lift it, and he's doing it in the movie, but it's just like exaggerated five times normal. It's just
fantastic. That's what I'm saying. Those are the things. Those are the things that you're like, okay. Like it would be one thing is like I look at it this way. Like you watch, I don't know. There's movies now that are made. That are super violent, like the John Wick movies and whatever. People getting shot, but no one blink an eye, right? You don't even blink an eye. Okay, great. But like that, like his teeth falling out, right? Kind of thing, whatever. Like he's sitting there and he's just biting at his nail. He's like, huh? And those are the things. You're like, how is that so much grosser and so and still. Ooh, kind of thing. And I watch all kinds
teeth
of stuff.
Falling out is like the only recurring dream I have as an adult. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, teeth falling out are the number one anxiety dream, thing, and we were saying cancer and puberty, also radiation poisoning.
Yes,
it reminds me of reading the books about Hiroshima and stuff, and when the people are like just starting to realize that their bodies are just basically melting,
just to piggyback on the thing again, like. Okay, in the thing, stuff is turning into a walking head or opening up and looking like a fucking lotus flower. Yeah. There's nothing that out of bounds in The Fly. I mean,
the baboon getting turned inside out is the most bizarre.
I have a question about that. So Seth is having trouble with living tissue. Right, he can send inanimate objects through just fine. He doesn't start with a rat. Yeah. He starts with a baboon,
and more baboons on deck too.
He's got more of them.
Where's this guy getting his baboons? Well,
you're going to start with something
clearly.
That's close to
clearly,
human.
The baboon lobby was all over this movie.
Well, the thing is, Canada, where life is cheap, clearly.
Yeah. If you had real baboons,
they'd kill you.
Waiting to be your experiment in that little warehouse space that he was living in. That baboon's like hanging out with him. The second baboon, the second baboon just hanging out, being his buddy. No, there would be baboon shit everywhere because they'd be flinging it all over. You would have to have three people with those sticks with the little nooses on the end, like animal control people have, walking that bat. These baboons are just like, hey, what's that? Oh yeah, I'll go in there, and boom.
Yeah, that ain't happening.
I'm reading it. There's the cat monkey scene where Brundle fuses a cat and the remaining baboon, and then has to beat it to death with a pipe. was cut following the Toronto screening. So it existed, according
sounds
to
sounds too much like Return of the Living Dead.
Well, according to Stuart Cornfield, who I'm assuming was the producer, he said there was no turning back for Seth. And then once that happened, everyone in the movie turned against him. They had no more sympathy for him, and which they didn't want to do. They want you to feel sympathetic for him the whole time, right? Yeah. But I'm like, if you had merged a cat and a baboon together, I think, and this is why Jaws works so well, right? Sometimes you have to show restraint in what you're putting on the screen, whether that's because the fucking shark didn't work, or because you're like, well, I want to tell a story there where this is actually what happened. Sometimes showing that restraint allows you to make the movie more intense or better it, right?
Splicing a baboon and a cat
if he had
just
murdered a whole
sounding.
Bunch of animals before he tries himself, there'd be very little.
Right. I mean that one baboon got turned inside, then the next thing he did, it works. You're just like, oh, okay. Like, you know, like he was clearly upset about the baboon, you know, turning inside out. It's fucking gross, you know, kind of thing. But like the whole idea was like, well, I'm going to do it myself. Like, it wasn't that I'm going to keep torturing these poor animals. I think of it like this. Do you guys remember Event Horizon, right? The movie that was literally butchered down by about 40 minutes of all the gore in it being taken out. And it's still really intense. The whole point was, they said when originally they put it together, they said it was too much. People just couldn't handle this level of violence and sadism and all this stuff. And it's like, as a horror fan, I'm like, man, I really want to see that, because I want to see what was too much, right? But what happened is the ones that happen, like the hat, like they're less than, like they're like a couple frames, and it's all part of the, when he's visions of hell, you know, I'm trying to remember what part, it's in the part, the latter half of the movie when he's like having all the visions. People in their mind have filled in what those things are. It happened too fast. So their mind starts filling in the stuff that's way more horrific than anything they ever filmed. And that's part of the problem, is that like sometimes when you cut stuff out, the audience's mind starts filling in the blanks, and what I fill in and whatever, you know, is going to be different, but it's going to be, you think, like, this has to be horrific. And what I think is horrific and what you think is horrific might be totally different, but it's still horrific to us. And it elicits the same response. By not having that, by showing the baboon once and then the other baboon comes through, your mind doesn't have to fill in what else did he do. If you showed him doing it to a couple of different animals, you would have started saying, well, did he do it to this? Did he do it to this? Did he do it? Like, you don't want that to happen, because you want people to feel bad for him. You know, he made a fly got in there. It was a mistake. The machine not knowing not to merge them. It's such a different. It's funny because the original The Fly with Vincent Price, he doesn't play the fly. He plays the brother, right? That movie, they don't show you anything. Like, they show you as the fly very little or whatever, but they couldn't. But the whole idea there is, it's like, you know, it's so much less about the relationship between the scientist and his wife at the time. It's more about like the mystery behind all what happened. I don't think you can tell that here. I think you have to tell it, the relationship there, because audiences at this time were looking for that. If you want to put butts, you know, every 12 inches, you need to have something that's going to pull in people to the theater to have them connect with. You know, as I said, Cronenberg was not known for that up to this point. I mean, you know, Scanners opens with the guy's head blowing up. I'm just saying. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, you wouldn't have gotten him to make this movie unless he could approach it the way in his David Cronenberg, you know, in his body horror way. And I think people were, I mean, it's that perfect movie where it gives you something to quote unquote feel good about, like you're getting a enriching movie experience watching this human relationships, and you can tell it's really well done. But at the same time, you get to see somebody's arm get snapped during, you know, while well, this sort of baboon turned inside out, and it's just a perfect thrill ride, in the theater, and at that time, you know, this was after I don't know if it was after Reanimator came out, but it was definitely after Return of the Living Dead, and Scanners, and it was after like The Thing. There'd been a whole run of really gory
stuff. Reanimator was 85. Yeah, this is after Reanimator. Reanimator was 85.
So this was just sort of like the distillation of all those, and let's present it to a mainstream audience. Mm-hmm. And 40 years ago, the Fly movies, the original Fly movies weren't even 40 years old at that point, you know.
No, they were closer to 30 years old.
30, it was 58. The original was 58.
Yeah, yeah. So they were just considered horror classics at that time. So everybody was familiar with The Fly, and everybody was, you know, not so much anymore, but everybody, you know, if you said The Fly, everybody would go, "Help me, help me." And, you know, it was just a well-known thing. So it had everything. It had the, and there was also a lot of nostalgia for that time period and stuff. So it was just the perfect combination. And it was also, well, I think this was also on the forerunning of like a reboot redo of an old movie, where you take it and you truly modernize it. Sort of, when did the remake of The Blob come out?
88.
That was
88.
Okay, that's Chuck Russell.
So that was sort of in the same time period. So this was like the first like really like, I think, big like reimagining, you know, take of a classic movie that was done really well, you know, that wasn't just trying to redo the movie. It was just modernize it. It took the concept and made it more mature, I guess, by being like, let's treat this as if it's really would be happening today in science. And, you know, I'm sure the science, you know, like the computer is hilarious, how the computer works in it and stuff. But
it was cutting edge for 86.
Yeah, it was. It just has to be plausible enough to be like, okay, this could sort of happen in science today. Yeah. And, it was just the perfect combination of it. Like, oh.
I always find it funny when you look at, like, the Alien, like, Alien and then Aliens. Not the more current ones, right? But, like, the computers are the computers they would have had in 1970, whatever. And you're like, well, okay. Like, you're just buying, like, you know, like...
Why does this computer have to take up a whole room and...
Yeah, like, you know, you know. I mean, like, when he's in with Mother... And whatever, and you're like, huh, that's crazy to think that, like, because obviously they take place, you know, far in the future kind of thing, but it's like, huh, but that's what the computers look like. Except in this movie, that's what computers looked like then. So it makes perfect sense that would be the computer he has.
We could run most of the Nostromo right now on an app, you know. We could have a Nostromo app that would do, like, 90% of the work on the Nostromo. Set wake up time for crew and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
So what food to thaw out, and you're off to the races.
So feed, you know, the cat. Part of what you were saying there with like the idea of the remakes and stuff like that, and if you obviously Carpenter's reimagining of The Thing, and he had said flat out, mm-hmm. He said it. I don't know if you guys have seen it, I've seen it, but The Thing Expanded, which if you haven't seen the documentary, phenomenal documentary. Well worth everyone. If you haven't seen it, go check it out. The Thing Expanded is phenomenal. He talks about the idea. I didn't want to make The Thing. I had no desire to make The Thing. He goes, The Thing's my favorite movie. Like when I'm from Howard Hawks.
Right.
He goes, but I can't say no. It's a studio movie. He goes, what am I going to do? So he goes, I got to change it. I can't just tell the same story. And I'm like, exactly. Right. If you look back and as somebody who I've said from jump, the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers to me is one of the most perfect films made, especially at the time. I have like, about how it can, you know, kind of just the way it is, right? But the remake in 78 or 76, I forgot. Now I'm forgetting a year, but you know what I'm talking about. The remake with Donald Sutherland and stuff like that is really good.
But that was in the 70s.
Yeah, 70s. I don't remember if it was 78 or 76. But like,
I got
you. But if the original had never been made into a movie and that was the original, I think, you know, I mean, it wouldn't, like, people wouldn't have been like, eh, like, they would have still been like, wow, that's really good. And there's a lot of people who like the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the new one, more than the one in the 50s, because again, it's a different time frame depending where you were born and stuff
the
like that.
The one in the 50s had the Red Scare going on at the same time, so that added a lot to it. Where in the 70s, it was just sort of general Watergate paranoia, but it wasn't the same, you know?
But it's a lot of loss of self and the idea of, like, there was different worries in the world. What I'm saying is, that movie's not that different than the source material. So even though a lot of people say, oh, the remake of Invasion of Mighty Snatchers, I love that remake, that's much more of a remake. That's not a reimagining, right?
Right, right. It's, you know, basically kind of the same movie with the same movie, in a modern skin. Yeah.
Right, which is why Carpenter's The Thing, even like The Fly here, again, conceptually, it's still a guy who gets a fly merged with him. But unlike the original, there is no human fly. There's no fly with a human head and hand out there, right?
Right,
yes.
You know, that's the whole point, is that this is no, it's all merging it together. And when you look at other, like, you know, again, we would go through the whole remake cycle in the 90s. And, like, if it's going to sound crazy, but and I'm not saying it's a good movie. It's shot well. But Gus Van Sant's scene for scene remake of Psycho.
Yes.
That kind of was kicked off that whole, it was the very beginning of it. And it's not good. But I think if you took that movie, that idea of it, and they had tried to but he's like, what, you're making a shot-for-shot remake? Like, this isn't going to work. Like, it's just not going to work. But
well, I don't even know if he was shot-for-shot. He was just like, I'm doing it off the original script.
Well, but what I'm saying is, but that's the whole idea. Like, he tried to do the same beats. But what I'm saying is, I don't know if that's going to work, because we already have now seen some reimaginings where we've taken a concept of something we know, that we know what it is, and now I've done something different with it. When you're saying I'm going to make Psycho, and then you kind of make Psycho, but every chance they go to be is, when it's not scene for scene, it's so garishly different. The colors are really bright. It's really fucking different. He has Norman Bates jerk off while watching her in the shower. Like, what?
Right.
Like, how are those the fucking choices you made? And that aside, I'm saying is, when we saw those reimaginings starting to happen, when you took properties that were known, The Fly was a known thing, the original, A Thing from Another World, those were classics. Those were movies that you went to the theater and you saw them when they were out and you kind of remembered them. And yeah, those are sci-fi classics. Now you have these new directors, young directors, who are now going to reimagine things and take things that were, you know, that normal say. I mean, think about this, is that, and I know Stuart Gordon, you know, was, he did say that. He goes, Reanimator is I understand it's based on Herbert West's Reanimator, which is by H.P. Lovecraft. But there's a lot of Frankenstein in it, for fuck's sake. That's what a lot is there, I kind of think. But how many different Frankenstein takes could they do? How many, you know, kind of thing? How many Jekyll and Hyde? How many whatever? Because those are those classic stories they try to kind of stretch it here, stretch it there. Some work, some don't. But when you are going to push the envelope by way, the amount of gore, the amount of violence, the amount of over the top you're going to put in there, you know, you have to make sure your story's solid, because if it's not, you lose people. And I think that's what we see a lot of. I mean, unfortunately, as horror fans, we are able to, you know, something is bloody and gory. Okay, the story can still be there or it's not. A lot of people, the blood and gore is going to stop them from ever seeing the story, you know, kind of thing, which is why I think a lot of movies are not, especially the movies that are now cult classics or, we, you know, modern classics kind of thing, they're not discovered until later. You know, at least The Fly, it did well. When it came out, it did really well. I remember being, you know, and it still holds up today. How many movies come out, they do really well, and they die off? The Fly is still, you know, you could still watch it. It still looks good. I watched the 4K. It looks great.
It takes place in such a generic look. Like, what I love about The Fly is, like, the streets are dirty. It's a dirty old warehouse space. Her car, like, she's not, like, you know, everybody has nice cars in movies. Her car's falling apart. You can see rust all over it. You know, they found a real, like, just working person's car. And it's awesome, but it's so self-contained that there's nothing, like, one of the, like, hairstyles a little bit will age, will put it in its age. The cars and the pack of Marlboro mediums on a desk Marlboro at one mediums. Point. I was just like, oh my God, Marlboro mediums. Otherwise, it's very self-contained, and the computer doesn't really work like a computer ever did or ever became now. I'm sure you could make a computer that functions like that, but nobody would want it these days. You know, just sort of the way he was talking to, you know, just like, computer, what if you did this, type, and the computer, computing, yes, I can do that, you know, that sort of thing.
But is that really much different than what everybody does now with their AI engine?
Who cares? It's serving it serves the story, and it doesn't dwell upon it an awful lot. And, you know, and his setup is basically, you know, two chambers with, you know, he makes it simple with tubes attaching the two of them, you know, so you know at the end when someone has to shoot one of the tubes to do, you know, everything is just laid out simply.
Well,
to
and I will story I will say this, and I will say this, something that I don't think I obviously I didn't catch it when I was younger, but I love that Cronenberg sets up the finale right when Ronnie first goes to Seth's warehouse. Right, mm-hmm. Because she asks about, well, what's this one? Oh, that's the prototype. And he's like, it works, but it's kind of clunky, right? He kind of dismisses it. But then that becomes crucial in the last reel, right? That there are three of them. And it's like, you know, now Brundle has the plan, right? The Brundlefly has a plan that we're going to be the ultimate family.
Yep.
And
absolutely fat at all in it. Yep.
Right. That's lean. And Jay, you said it as well, that, you know, the audience turned on Seth when they had the baboon cat thing, and they wanted to feel illicit sympathy. When he comes out of the last chamber, and he's not only been mutated into the full fly, but now he has the chamber itself, right?
Yep.
He has literally become one with his own creation, right? His creation that he, you know, you're talking about he's the monster and Frankenstein, right? He made this thing. And it is killing him, and now he and it are the same thing. You feel so much for him. It's like that he's already, we've literally watched him dying in front of us for 90 minutes, and now he's literally been fused with a machine, and all he wants is death. And it's like, God, this is so nuts. Right?
Well, Cronenberg did a little magic
so bad
act
for him.
Because we haven't even mentioned the ex-boyfriend in here, who's the classic 80s beard prick guy, you know, like the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. The guy with that
like
kind
Peck
of beard was always a prick.
Walter Peck.
Yes,
yeah.
Ghostbusters. Yeah. They were always the prick in the movie,
sir.
And he's a
man
super
no
prick in this movie.
Yeah, that's my favorite line in Ghostbusters. Yes, Your Honor, this man has no dick. So
this man has
Well,
no
Stath is and
my favorite
was
part in Ghostbusters is when the you know the Cardinal's there and he just gives the high sign.
Yeah,
when they're in the mayor's office. Yeah.
But
I'm just saying. Sorry.
No, but Matt, but Stath is which is yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
He takes that guy who I've always hated him in the movie, but at the end he does this little magic trick where we're sympathetic with Brundle right up until the second where he wants to force his girlfriend into the other machine. And then you're feeling sorry, you know, you're feeling sorry for her and you're like, you know, fuck the fly. He's all flied out now. He's a bad guy. And then at the same time, you're starting to feel bad for Beardo guy. You're starting to root for Beardo guy to, you know, after getting his hand and ankle melted off.
Oh, God,
and,
melted.
And, you know, and he's about to melt his head, and you're just like, oh, no, you know. And it's like, wait a minute, no, I should want that guy to get melted. And then he turns you on Brundle. He makes you feel sorry for the biggest asshole in the movie. And then he turns it around again, and you're feeling sorry for Brundle again. It's all just like, I love stuff like that. I love stuff where you have a pricky character in the movie, and he doesn't really do much to redeem himself. But you just are like, go like, oh well, you know, he's a human being. You know, I don't want to see this guy get his face puke melted off.
Yeah,
you know. And which they don't usually do in horror movies, but David Lynch adds that extra layer to it, you know, that just gives it a little more flavor. A little more bile-like flavor.
Yeah, this is a rough one. It really is. It doesn't matter when you watch it, whether you're a kid or a teenager or an adult. It's just like...
It's rough, but it's a very pleasurable watch. Like, I was just sitting through it going, like, what a great movie this is, you know? It's been so long since I've seen it, that's why.
Yeah, I hadn't watched it in a while either.
Well, so they were showing this for a while. They were showing, like, on HBO or Cinemax, one of those things. They were kind of always... It gets in a rotation every once in a while, and they show it, right? So I caught it a little while ago. Might have been during COVID. Just caught the end of it, caught whatever, like, because Haley was with me, and she's like, what's it? I'm like, it's the end of The Fly, like, kind of thing, like, you know, it's not a movie she's seen, so it's not like we're gonna, like, I'm, like, popping it on, and, like, what's what? Like, if Aliens is on, and we catch it, and it's not with commercials and stuff, it's not unheard of that we'll watch the last hour of Aliens, because that goes by really quick, you know what I'm saying? But it's one of those things that, you know, I said to, when it's on, it's like, I'm always shocked when I see it, you know what I'm saying? Not like, it's like, I'm like, this is just not mainstream enough. In my head, I'm thinking that. But I'm like, wait, this is probably the most mainstream thing that Cronenberg made, especially up to this point, for sure. That's why I'm always a little more shocked when you see, like they're like, oh, we're going to show Rabbit. You ain't ever fucking show Rabbit on TV. Like that, right. You know,
well, the besides thing also,
Marilyn Chambers.
Well, but the thing also with The Fly is that even disregarding the Cronenberg aspect, it's got that name, right? Everybody, like you were saying, Chris, everybody knows, help me, right? That's a horror classic. So you can say that, and it's like, oh, okay, it's a fly. It's like, oh, this is that the remake. This is the one from the 80s. And those of us, you know, our age, we remember that, and that still has a cachet, right? Because it's, I said, critically it was well-received, commercially it was well-received. So it's like, yeah, that's a good programmer, right? And it's R, and it's a legitimate R, but it's not... We all know this. You can get away with an R
it's
that's
not the brood.
Violent and gross.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Right. It's not... they are so tasteful with the nudity in this movie, right? It's... I am... You know, that's what sells me on Cronenberg as a filmmaker, right? Because Seth picks up Tawny, and that's Joy Bushel, right? And she manages to be topless, but you don't see anything, which is incredible. Right, the way that they do that, it's like I understand how they did that, and it's like I'm willing to show, you know, literally a guy vomiting acid onto another guy's ankle, but I can't show
David
a pair
Lynch,
of boobs. Yeah,
it's a David Lynch movie. You are lucky that there's not just a full throbbing vagina in it. You know, I mean, it's not going to be a vagina, but there's going to be something. You know, there's going to be a vagina in someone's chest or something
yonic,
or Marilyn Chambers with a little penis coming out of her armpit. You know,
armpit.
So
penis.
Stop, Chris. My dick.
I can only get so hard.
I can only get so erect. I can only get so erect. Please.
My favorite. I love that on Archer. Please, my penis can only get so erect.
Oh God.
Yeah. But yeah,
it's a wonder the three of us are married.
No, not. But that's the thing is that my wife, if she heard me say that, she would be like, "Uh-huh." Like,
yeah.
I mean, she's not a big Archer fan, but she would figure it's got to be from one of those stupid things I watch that she doesn't watch. I have said it. I'm like, this is how we get ants. Is that what you want?
You want to get ants?
Is that what you want? You want ants?
Because this is how you get ants.
Oh, my God. My wife goes, that's from Archer. I go, yeah, because she only knows that because I've said it so much. She goes, what's that from? And I've said it. It's like, that's how we get ants. Do you want to have ants? But, yeah, sorry. Anyway.
You know, nobody wants ants.
We're not talking about the ants.
Ants or silverfish or millipedes. Oh, my God. Nobody wants any of that shit.
House centipedes, man. House centipedes. Creepy.
Well, thing with, you got to watch out because millipedes are a more common pest, and millipedes are herbivores, right? They're not really much of a menace, right? They just get in shit, you know? But centipedes are venomous, right? A centipede can do some damage to you if they bite you. So you got to watch out for that shit too, man. No kidding.
You don't seem to be living till he bites you.
I trained my millipedes to attack the centipedes.
That doesn't work, though.
Hmm.
Because again,
you have to bring in rats to eat all the other things. And then,
right, and then you
got to
get
rat
cats,
problem.
Right?
Yeah. Well, stop threatening me with a good time. This is all sounding great.
Don't threaten me with a good time.
You need dogs, and then...
Do we have to... Are you gonna turn it to Dr. Moreau, Chris?
I do have a book of the law that I have been... I've been crafting up the last few years, and I've got a few. Yeah, you know, but
the law has been broken.
I maybe we'll have to have a contest to see which animals that I'm gonna hybrid. It actually, Dr. Moreau, they weren't human and animal hybrids. They were animals that he actually tweaked into humans.
Yes.
I just read the comic adaptation.
You know, it's just
have
so funny is.
I have that comic adaptation.
I was about to say, it's like
the art in it is gorgeous. It was
so did they adapt the movie or did they adapt the original
the movie
story?
It's the movie.
Yeah.
So you know what's so funny is Island of Lost Souls, the addition of the Panther Woman was like people were up in arms. How dare they put in this character that's not part of the story? And I'm like, man, if they only knew what was coming.
They live
like,
now, man. Right. Forget it.
You know what's so
they
funny
lost
is,
their fucking
is,
minds.
I don't know if you guys have ever, you ever seen the documentary they did about, like, the Richard Stanley's documentary about when he was supposed to be making Island of Dr. Moreau, but got fired off it, and then he hid with
interviews off that documentary.
Oh,
of him
my God.
Talking
like,
about it.
That move, I mean, the Burt Lancaster's Island of Dr. Moreau, I saw it when I was a kid and stuff like that. I mean, it's no Island of Lost Souls. I'm going to say that. Island of Lost Souls is a classic, right? With Charles Laughton and stuff in the white suit and whatever. But
the makeup was really good in that.
Oh,
remake,
no. Right. But I'm saying sure. But the movie itself, Island of Lost Souls, 1933, is that's a classic movie, right? The Island of Dr. Moreau, then from the 70s, right? With Burt Lancaster or whatever, that movie, like, it's not bad. It's just the problem is it's not the movie itself isn't made the same way. It's not shot with the way the
style.
The
effort was put into the makeup,
makeups,
which was beautiful.
Yeah. And
but like
those...
the style was very 70s, just sort of standard 70s style.
And it's funny because the thing is, it's I'm trying to remember, what is it, like a decade before that they made Planet of the Apes, and you're like, well, you have a blueprint of how to shoot a movie that look like this. Planet of the Apes is just so, I think Planet of the Apes, the problem is it's just so good and it's shot so well that like other movies that might have that same characteristic and style to it just don't necessarily live up to it. But it's hard to do. The freaking thing was like an Academy Award winning movie. Anyway, but what I was saying is, and I'm going to tie this in because that's going to happen, right? The Island of Dr. Moreau from the 70s, a lot of people love that movie, and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's certainly not the original, the way it was shot, the stylized, whatever. Conceptually, same idea as Island of Lost Souls, but they did it in a different style. Now, you look at the newest one with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer, that fucking debacle, right? If that movie, if Richard Stanley had stayed on and directed that whole movie and they hadn't had all the issues with the fact that they had to drive 2.5 hours in and everyone was getting high and drunk and fucked up every night and they were fucked up on set and people were getting at it. Like, if you could have, like...
And Brando was there.
Yeah, Yeah, well, Brando himself was a disaster, and Val Kilmer was trying to become Brando. But if you could have, like, made that movie without, and got rid of all that bullshit, just made the actual movie, we would be able to compare it better. But I'm saying is, they didn't try to change it too far from the original story, so it's another one you have to direct compare it to. It is not a reimagining. That's one of the, I think, the reason why, we've said this a number of times tonight, that certain movies that are the reimaginings of classics, they're able to stand on their own. You can have the 1958 version of The Fly and Cronenberg's The Fly, and they both can stand next to each other, and you don't have to compare them. They don't have to compare to each other, because they are, in fact, similar but different. And
they're not
different
really
enough.
The same movie.
Yeah.
They're
just, I mean, it's a guy in a fly.
The concept of a guy has a transporting chamber, things go wrong involving a fly. That's
right.
It. That's the only thing they have.
Well,
in
right,
common,
and both,
you know, the basic
and both
concept.
Of those. I mean, it takes the concept from the story, right? Because I mean, there the fly was based on the short story by George Langalon. Right, so that it takes those basic elements and spins a new story out of it, which is again why it works so well. Because that, I mean, other than like I said, the help me, and the visual of the human with the fly head and the fly with the human head. Do you remember anything about the original The Fly, off the top of your head?
No.
No, you don't. But you remember.
I do.
Right. You remember that. Right. So that's in one way why this is the perfect film for Cronenberg to take and make it, because it's got a ton of cachet on the name and it's got a lot you can do with it. And he does that. He takes it in a completely different direction while still honoring what the actual story's about. So that, I mean, that's why it works. It's the same. I mean, and you know, Jay, you mentioned the remake of The Blob. I put that in the same boat, because it does take the same idea. What's The Blob about? It's about this big gelatinous monster, and and everything it touches it consumes. Okay, let's do that, but let's take it and spin it in a different direction, but still honor what The Blob was actually about, rather than either going completely into left field or doing it so slavishly that there's no reason to watch the remake.
Right, so that's the other thing, too, is the thing from another world to the thing, reimagining. Science fiction to, let's be honest, I understand the Carpenter's thing is science fiction. It's a horror movie. It's a horror movie as well as being science fiction, right? The Fly, the original, science fiction. This movie, it's still science fiction, but it is still a horror movie in there as well. There's more horrific things. The Blob with Steve McQueen, right? People get eaten, but nothing happens. The Blob, I will guarantee, that is a horror movie. That's a science fiction, but it's a horror movie. You watch people get dissolved and eaten, but you had to do that. You had to. Science fiction couldn't live as just science fiction anymore, because the monsters a lot of it has to do with the fact that you're talking about something from the 50s to the 80s and stuff, and the terror, the horror that we saw in the world, that we saw, you know, every day on the news, the all the stuff that the Vietnam and all that other stuff that all had happened, made us as a consumer, and what we had to see for us to take that, you had to step that up, right? And the horrors that are real, the things that happen in the really real world, make you have to step up what you're putting on screen. Otherwise, it's just outdated and quaint, right? But we can look back at old movies and say, okay, well, that was made in the 50s, or that was made in the 40s. Yeah, like Wolfman has to have pants on, otherwise his wolf dork hangs out. You know, we can't have that, right? You know?
He's got nards?
Wolfman's got nards. Oh, my God, I love Montrose White. Sorry. But I'm saying it's one of those things you start looking at those, like, how do I take those older things? The Land Unknown was on the other day, and Haley goes,
"What
movie is this?"
That was on Svengoolie. That was on Svengoolie the other night.
It was, and I said to Dad this morning, actually, I said, "Land Unknown." He goes, "That movie is so bad, Jay." I go, "Right." I said, "But it wouldn't be great if they remade it with like actual money and actual things and whatever?" Because the Land Unknown, as if you've never seen it, folks, the special effects are garbage. But there's reasons for that. That's a whole other podcast. The whole idea was that the story, the idea wasn't bad. It's just they didn't have any money to make it. Had it had been a classic, let's say they had given it all the money it was supposed to get, and This Island Earth hadn't kind of derailed it and ruined it for them and everything, we might have got a Land Unknown reimagining souped up version, you know, where we had these special effects to make the dinosaurs look real, like especially after Jurassic Park and stuff like that, right? We could get those things. It's one of those things. Sometimes you look at something like, that's really cool. I'd love to do this, but we can't do it yet. Or now we can do that. Now I can do those things. So now can I tell that story? I always, and I know it's one of those, there's a million movies that you like, I wish they had happened. I truly wish that Universal had figured it out to allow Carpenter and his wife, you know, kind of thing. They were going to work on it because his wife talks about it all the time, to do Creature from Black Lagoon. Carpenter's Creature, they had the suit, they had the designs, they had everything done, and they did fun because they got tied up with other stuff. I would have loved to see what Carpenter would have changed the Creature from Black Lagoon into, right? Still paying homage to the classic, the Creature from Black Lagoon, right? The Gill Man, but what would he have done? How would he have made his different? Because he doesn't make the same movie. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, let's be honest. How many Carpenter movies are just fucking Westerns anyway? Right? Because he loves Westerns. They're just fucking Westerns. But can you tell me they're Westerns? I mean, they are, but like Assault on Precinct 13? Yep. These are all just Westerns. That's all they are. They're siege movies. Bravo. Right. But the thing is, if you don't know that, you can still appreciate the movie for what it is. Right? That's one of the great things. When you, The Hateful Eight, when you watch The Hateful Eight, you're like, this is the thing. This is what this fucking movie is, the fucking thing. But if you've never seen The Thing, you can still watch Hateful Eight and appreciate it. You know,
I'm sorry, you're talking about, oh, this is just a Western. I saw a great anecdote the other day that when The Magnificent Seven came out, Akira Kurosawa wrote a letter to Sergio Leone. And he was like, and it was translated, and it was like, oh, you made a very good film. I enjoy your film very much, but you must admit, it's basically the same as my film. And I think you should pay me. And he made more money off of that than he'd ever did on any film he actually made.
Well, you know, it's funny is the Seven Samurai, you know, kind of thing. Like, that's a movie, again, I know some people, because it's not in English and whatever, but, like, it is, a lot of people had never seen that when The Seven came out. So it's not like people could have drawn that connection. You know what I'm saying? The audiences. And The Magnificent Seven was just like, whoa. You know what I'm saying? For by way of Westerns. But, and this is the thing, think about the Westerns that came before Magnificent Seven, right? Kind of thing, like all the John Wayne movies and all. There's tons and tons of Westerns.
The Gene Autry's and everything else, too.
Yeah, right. All those Westerns. And they're all different. They have a lot of the same stuff. And then Peckinpah makes The Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
And the
shit
Wild
gets Bunch, real.
Right? But what did he do? He said, hey, I'm making this movie. And then again, Dad always talks about it. Dad missed the last day of school to literally go see that movie, the first showing the day it came out. I think he saw it twice in the same day. Like, Dad always talked about how much he loved The Wild Bunch. And then you watch The Wild Bunch, and you're like, this is a Western, obviously, right? But it's about the end of cowboys. It's about, like, they're a dying breed. Like, wait, this is not even The Magnificent Seven. This is something different. And the violence is turned up, right? That's what we're getting here. That's what we got with the when you transition from what's old to the new, the stuff in the 80s, the remakes, the reimaginings and stuff like that. It is hard as a just a movie fan in general. If you don't know your history, you know, and I'm not trying to be mean to people, but like if someone's younger than us, let's say, maybe much younger than us, and they don't know their history about movies, like, well, they'll say, this is, I'm like, well, dude, check this out. That movie's old. That movie's in black and white. That movie's from the 80s. It's got to be ancient. I'm like, okay, but like, there's a reason why you like this thing. This person's making this movie again, right? Which is not to say that you can't improve upon something or take that idea and roll it in there. I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, you know, new original ideas, movies that are truly original. I don't know how many truly original ideas exist at all. You know what I'm saying? In the world of film, it's always borrowing from something, right? Kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, it's Die Hard on a plane or something like that, right?
Right? Yeah,
that's how movies get made. Is you pitch them in a way that's the way the executives understand.
And
it's
when
like,
something
it's like food. There's only so much food that humans mm-hmm. can eat that's edible, and those different flavors, you have those flavors to work with, but it's the combination of things that's originality, and you know, and what the combination and you know the style put into the presentation of that combination of stuff. Is how you get something that's new or feels new or whatever,
right.
you know?
Right. Well, that's the thing too, is that when we look at those, like what your influences are, who they are, and you start learning about the directors and who the director is and where they got this influence and where this stuff, and those things start making sense. I'm trying to think of like, when you sometimes will say like, this movie is so out there, so different, so original compared to what we're getting, the cookie cutter stuff. And then you look at it, and sometimes it's like that fucking, what's that fucking beaver movie that you loved, Chris?
Hundreds of Beavers?
Hundreds of Beavers, right? That movie's crazy, right? Kind of thing, right? But it's not.
So did you finally saw Hundreds of Beavers?
I watched some of it. I didn't see all of it.
Okay,
but I'm saying is
so. So wait a minute. Is this a horror movie or a porno? Which
it's
one?
There's
I couldn't. In my mind, I haven't talked a single person into seeing Hundreds of Beavers, and it's one
I
of
started
the
watching some
movies
it looks,
I've seen in a long time.
Right.
I mean, in real life, I'd like to see Hundreds of Beavers, and I don't mean the animal, but
I'm just saying it is like something like that. It doesn't hit the mainstream, but then and like the movie we talked about last time, we talked about Obsession. And people are like, oh my God, there's the current generation. They're like, this movie is so like, and yet we look at it and go, okay, I can see this influence. I can see this. I can see this. I understand where he's coming from. Right. We get that as people who enjoy film and stuff like that. And I think, and again, this is the full circle. We've gone all the way on the track twice. Here we go. Right. That's what Cronenberg's doing. That's what he's able to take. He's taking his style, what he wants to do. He can take a concept and an idea that is still a guy gets in a pod with a fly, and he put his spin on it. Now, think about how many different people.
He's an obsessive, so he's got obsessions that are always going to drive his movies. So that's what one of the things that just makes him great is he's driven.
Yep.
To explore that aspect of things, you know, especially the things that nobody really wants to explore. He's like compelled to do it. So,
yeah. Well, also, how many future filmmakers did Cronenberg help inspire? Did Carpenter help inspire? Did, you know what I'm saying? Like those, the crop of filmmakers that came after them that watched their movies and said, I want to make film because I love this. This inspires me. Where they look back, where Carpenter talks about how Howard Hawks, you know, and things like those people inspired him and the Westerns and all, right? They had to get their inspiration, and that's what it is. But it's making it new and fresh and making it still somewhat different so it doesn't feel like it's a straight cookie cutter, you know? And I can honestly tell you, to this day, I don't think I've seen, I understand, like, there's nothing before The Fly that is straight cookie cuttered to what that, it wasn't like this was cookie cuttered out of something else, right? It took him making Rabbit. It took him making Scanners. It took him making The Brood. It took him making, you know, Videodrome to get there. Like you watch Cronenberg's movies and yes, there's connective tissue, but it still is its own thing. You know, I mean, to this day, the baby, when she licks the baby in The Brood after she births him, it's gross. It's gross as shit, you know, kind of thing. When she takes the bit and starts licking it, like I'm like, okay. I remember watching it with dad, and I did it for Boss Bugs and Babes, and he's like, I forgot that scene. It's disgusting. I said, it is disgusting, Dad. But it's probably the most natural thing.
He's one of those
guys.
He didn't want It's very much like David Lynch. Didn't set out to be a filmmaker, but he had obsessions about things, and he was like, I'm going to try film as an experiment. And his first few movies, you know, like when he was in a student film era, were very awkward and stuff. And you could just see him just, he was one of those people that was lucky enough, like when he was in Canada, they were like, yeah, we'll give you some Canadian tax money to make these movies, you know? And he just kept doing movies, and you can see, and like The Fly is the point where he's really mastered the craft of making a movie, you know?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Making a tight-ass movie with all, you know, everything connects to where it's supposed to connect. Everything has a purpose. Beginning, middle, and end. When it's done, it's over. And it's just completely satisfying. And it's only been uphill since then, too. You know, his movies have gotten more experimental even in a lot of times. But, like, by the time he hit, like, Eastern Promises and... what is it, History of Violence and stuff, those are more those are like almost more like mafia movies, you know.
Yeah, well, those
something.
Are different kind of thing too. Yeah,
yeah, they're still really, they still have some really crazy violence in them. Or oh, here's a good example of like where he hit art film, like filmmaker, experimental filmmaker, was Dead Ringers. Mm-hmm. While still making something that was like palatable just to normal film goers, you know, as a story wise, but just like this bizarre thing. But that wasn't very gory, and I don't think there was really any gore in that, if I recall. It was just disturbing themes,
just yeah, just but, weird as fuck. So
yeah, just
yeah,
just
I mean that, that's
creepy.
I mean that,
as,
that but you know that, but you're right, that's why we're still talking about The Fly some 40 years after it came out, is because of that, that it's not just, you know, it takes it and it imagines it in a different way, and it still has something to say, because for all Cronenberg, who I do want to get to this, he cameos in this film. He is the obstetrician in the vision, the dream that, that Ronnie has, which when he pulls the maggot out, it's like, oh my fucking God.
Well, he that, also that perfectly is just plays like a real doctor, but at the same time, the doctor is still a little detached and asshole-y in it. It's just, it's perfect. It's perfect. It's just so, off enough to be in a dream, and but
well,
still
the, and
close
so
enough
the reason,
to be real.
So, yeah, so the reason why he plays the obstetrician there, besides just to get a cameo, he's not like De Palma. I don't think he's cameoing just to riff on Hitchcock, right? But is that, I think it was Spielberg, when he met him, said that he didn't look like a filmmaker. He looked like a Hollywood plastic surgeon.
Martin Scorsese said that.
Scorsese, okay. I knew Scorsese, it was some Hollywood guy. Yep. Says he looked like a plastic surgeon, so he wanted to play a doctor, right? He does kind of look like a plastic
surgeon. He
should have
played the Surgeon General in Escape from L.A. then.
My oh, God, boy. They're real. But so if you want to see The Fly now, you've got some options. It's actually not really streaming anywhere, which is odd. But there's some good releases. I have the Shout Factory box set on Blu-ray, which is all five of The Fly films. So it's the three OGs plus The Fly and The Fly 2. That one is, I picked that one up during one of Shout's sales. It's a great set, really nice disc here. I mean, it's got some features and stuff, but just the visuals and the audio looks fantastic on that one. And so that one is out there. Plus, you get all the other ones, which is nice too. Now, I watched this one with my 15-year-old, and now he really wants to watch The Fly 2, and I'm like, it's not as good, I'm telling you.
Oh, okay, no.
But he really wants to watch it.
I like it quite a bit.
Not the same thing, yeah.
Unfortunately, it was not the movie they were going to make. But the original pitch for The Fly 2, which Mick Garris was going to put out, it was going to continue on this. It was going to be the next part of this whole thing. And they were like, yeah, you know what? We're going to make it without you. And then he went and he sat, because he got a writing credit on it. And he said he sat in his seat and kind of slinked down as low as he could, because he's like, what the fuck is this shit? You know, kind of thing. It wasn't what he put out there. Like Luke said, there's the collection, which I have the whole Fly collection. There is the regular Blu-ray out there and stuff. I think the stream, I have it digitally as well, that I got streaming. I think that's 4K. It's clean as hell, I'll tell you that. I mean, it holds up. kind of thing. Like, it's not like the movie is so old anyway, but I'm saying it holds up when you watch it on like a nice big TV, nice and clean. So,
yeah,
but yeah, well worth it. I mean, I think Luke, you
watched
it on your
archive.org.
Right. Yeah.
And this guy that's got he's posted the whole day. It's the David Cronenberg filmography. And yeah. I was just like, oh, well, that's cool. You know, The Fly's on here. I'm like, but he's already made a bunch of, you know, he's made a couple movies in the last few years, so this won't be up to date. And then I go to it, and I'm like, oh, goddamn, he's got whoever made the filmography of him is keeping up with it and putting his new movies up as soon as they're available.
It's David Cronenberg.
I hope it is.
It's like when you can tell the guys that clearly wrote their own IMDb page. Because it's like way too much information and detail in it.
Ah, okay.
I
like that.
Yeah. So, anyway, but yeah, but if you picked up the box that The Fly 2 is in there, if you wanted to watch that, Luke, did you watch yours on your VHS?
I did not watch it on the VHS because I know that on my big TV that would look kind of rough. That the VHS, a lot of them are just they're more show than go for some of these really old ones right now, you know.
Well, yeah, sometimes you got to watch the VHS on the like the little small CCTV kind of like, you know.
Well, I've got my 19-inch CRT sitting here next to me from this was one of my TVs from college, and that one's. Yeah, and I've got the dual VCR DVD player hooked up to this one, right? So that I'll watch movies on this one when I get some VHS tape.
Yeah.
So completely apropos of absolutely nothing, we were watching the remake of Father of the Bride, with Steve Martin, and there's a scene where he is going upstairs in their house, you know, their ridiculously large house that they have in that film. And there's and he walks past the TV, and sitting on top of the TV, I couldn't make him out, but there's two VHS tapes and an NES. I'm like, that is fucking awesome right there, man. That's beautiful. 1989, baby. But anyway, not that we ever had an NES, but you know, Master System all the way. Sega or die.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. So, yeah, folks, if you want to check it out, if you've never seen it, I don't know where you've been. But you know, well worth your time. Go check it out. I think it's a classic.
It is a classic, and I will reiterate, it is pretty fucking gross. So if you've got maybe a spouse or a kid or something who's not into gross shit, you know, just consider that. And by the same token, if you've got a spouse or a kid who loves gross shit, then consider that too, right? So
I like that you just say consider that and don't say, well, don't show it to your, because you know you have the parents who you like. Consider that, and they're like, oh, he doesn't like it? I'm dying to see his reaction.
Well, at the same time, you're a fucking adult. Figure it out, okay? I'm not here to tell you what to do, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah, for Christ's sakes, man.
Exactly.
I am not a role model.
You got that right.
I will actively subvert the raising of your kid because I don't have to deal with it, and it's amusing to me.
The one in the corner, bring him forward, he amuses me.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Test, test, say duh.
Duh.
Good luck.